Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Comté Cheese Association. Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd. I'm your host today, Jessica Kesselman. A few weeks ago, I spoke with Sarah Rowland of Bayou Sarah Farms about raising water buffalo in Louisiana and the learning process associated with milking and making buffalo milk cheese. In this episode, we're keeping the focus on water buffalo. I am so very excited to speak with my guest today, Alejandro Gomez-Torres of Boof Creamery. I've been a fan of their cheeses and their story for quite some time. Boof Creamery makes 100% grass-fed, free-range, award-winning buffalo milk cheese. They're based in Colombia, and they have a unique story that crosses three continents with familiar themes that I'm looking forward to discussing. Welcome, Alejandro, to Cutting the Curd.
Thank you, Jessica. This is very, very enlightening. Thank you for having me here with you.
And have you ever been on Cutting the Curd before?
I have not. This is my first time.
And I personally find that shocking because, and I'm actually very excited to be the one that gets to talk with you and share your story with our listeners because, you know, it is such a, it's such an innovative and unique story, but it's also very familiar and it kind of just is another example of the global, community we have in cheese. Can you tell us about Boof Creamery and about this farm? It's a fourth generation farm, correct?
Yes, Jessica. Well, thank you. Yes, Boof Creamery started with a fourth generation farm now that was not dedicated to milking water buffalo, but had a big water buffalo herd. So that farm is called Guaycaramo. It belongs to the Herrera family, my partners in the business. And they've been doing agriculture for generations now. It's, almost the fourth generation. In 2008, 2009, we started making cheese. But before that, we started milking buffalo. So the story of Boof Creamery starts in 2009. But we started milking buffaloes in 2006, even though we had the buffaloes there. So that's one of our farms now. And since time has gone by and there is more appetite for Boof, we've had to join more people into this picture. And we have now other suppliers that are raising buffaloes in the same way we're doing, water buffaloes, in different regions of Colombia. And I can tell you later why this is important now that we have a diversity of origins. We have different climates, different weather patterns. And this has been, by luck, really interesting for our product that's grass-fed. So it's been a while since we started. It seems like a short time, but a short time underwater.
Right. And I was really interested to read that water buffalo have been, that they've been at home in Colombia for quite some time. And that I think it was your website that said there are over 800,000 of them, one of the highest concentrations of water buffalo in the world. What is it about the climate and some of these locations of these farms that are so well suited to raising water buffalo?
Yes, Colombia has around 800,000 water buffalo head, and it all started when buffaloes were brought to Colombia to haul timber in the Pacific coast. The Colombian Pacific coast is rainy. I think it's the rainiest places on earth. And bringing out timber from those beautiful forests, tropical forests, was impossible with other animals back in the time. So water buffaloes were imported as draft power animals, and then timber stopped. Those are conservation areas now in Colombia, beautiful places to go visit. It's beautiful forest, pristine. And they moved to the Central Valley of Colombia in the Magdalena Valley, a very tropical, humid, rainy area. That's very similar to some of the climates in India and where in Asia, where water buffaloes roam and where they were originated. So Colombia became a very nice home and a very nice hotel for water buffalo. And they started being disseminated by different producers from central Colombia to different regions like the Llanos. Those are the eastern plains that are also rainy, but flat, open savannas. Always used as draft power and maybe as the colonizing animal. And that's why we were not aware of so many buffaloes in Colombia. You know, rivers here flood and then drain, and it's rainy season, then it's dry season. So buffaloes became like the accordion of animals that could adapt to drier areas, but also to floods. And that's how buffaloes started to populate and started moving to other regions of the country. It's been years since buffaloes are here. Now they're used for many purposes. Draft power still is very important. Also for dairy, also for meat. And it's a triple purpose animal for us in Colombia.
So for Boeuf Creamery, what was the impetus or the inspiration to decide we're going to start cheese making? How did that come about?
Well, my job when I first started working at the farm with the Herreras was to organize the herd. And we didn't know how many animals we had. We didn't know where were they. So we started rounding up buffaloes and rounding up and counting and doing. And once we had the herd organized and did the inventory, that took us like a year. This is all on horses. You know, it's open ranges. And we said, what do we do with the water buffaloes? And my partner, Luis and Roberto, they said, my God, we should do something value added. We shouldn't just, you know, have animals here just to have them. We use them for draft power, but we need to do something else. So that's when mozzarella pops into our heads. They had been to Italy a couple times and enjoyed a lot the fresh mozzarella they tried in Caserta and the southern part of Italy. So we wrote on a napkin and said, let's do mozzarella. We have, you know, at that time we had around 1,500 animals. Then it grew to like 3,000, 3,500 now. And that became our appetite. And for me, I'm an agricultural engineer born and raised in Colombia. Getting value added became really important. My dad's a farmer. He's a rice farmer. And he was used to getting the prices, not to setting the price. So I said, this is the opportunity to set a price for a product that has a lot of value and that can be exported. So we just launched without doing many numbers besides the napkin and said, we could be selling mozzarella to the world. It's a deficitary milk. There's not enough in the world. People love mozzarella. We eat fresh cheese. Let's just teach the world about Colombian water buffalo mozzarella. And that's the endeavor we started since 2008.
Is there a cheese making community in Colombia? Is cheese part of, like, is it something that you see in the culinary culture of Colombia? Or were you guys kind of like spearheading where you were?
there is a big culture, cheese culture in Colombia. We eat a lot of fresh cheese. So fresh cheese is melted on the arepa. Fresh cheese goes with our desserts, you know, with panela, with bocadillo, that's like guava paste. We eat cheese in many, many ways, but it's always fresh and always the main dish would be like something else with cheese, you know, plantains right. with cheese and those things. So the culture of cheese is not elaborate. We're not into fancy cheeses, even though there's a big industry of some of the aged cheeses, traditional companies of Swiss people who started them in Colombia, 100 years ago. It's a small market for those specialty cheeses. But we were the first ones to come out with a fresh cheese that was differentiated to the rest. And that's when Boof comes out. And we just focused on having the best of water buffalo milk and the best brightness of it. How do we make it bright? How do we make it shine? That was our main deal. And we profited from the fresh cheese culture in that it was not too hard to get Colombia to eat fresh mozzarella because mm-hmm. we were used to that. We are not used still to aged cheeses with smells and those strong characteristics. We're used to fresh cheeses. So it was easy to introduce the fresh mozzarella in our market, even though it came from a strange animal that, you know, swims in the mud and, you know, it's kind of strange, but it became a delicacy and we positioned it as a specialty product. So far it's been working out with the fresh cheese industry.
So it's interesting you were talking about the herd count, and it sounds like this is like a vast property and the water buffalo are roaming. And so can you tell us a little bit about like the day in the life of a water buffalo now that you're milking them? Is it the entire herd that is being used for milking? Is it just part of it? And how are you managing the milking? Yes. One of the reasons I ask is Sarah, when I talked to Sarah at Bayou Sarah Farms, she has a very small operation, and she talked about how she goes out to milk the buffalo where the buffalo is. She doesn't bring them in. And again, reading about Boof, it does sound like watering water buffalo, especially when you're committing to a grass-fed natural product, there's some interesting methods and approaches.
Yes, we first started with open vast lands. So if a pasture could be, you know, 50 hectares. That's like 150 acres, more or less. And then obviously that's where buffaloes were just roaming. We ended up choosing and selecting our herd. Some of the bufalas were old. Some of the bufalas just didn't want to be at the parlor and they were stressed. So we said, you know what? Let her be. She has to keep her lifestyle. And we didn't force any bufalas to be there. Some bufalas were easier to adapt to the milking parlor, the younger ones especially. So we ended up leaving some of those bufalas roam as they were used to. And they became the stepmoms of many of our little water buffaloes because they could help us, you know, feed the extra milk that the mom couldn't feed them, even though we milk with the calf on the side. Right next to the bufala, we needed a little bit more energy. So those bufalas could take care of two or three calves at the same time. And we kept those old ones as stepmoms, you know, as the kindergarten mom that takes care of most. And then we started shrinking the herd into the selected volume per buffalo. Each water buffalo can yield to us a gallon, maybe a gallon and a half a day, plus what she gives to the calf. The calf should be getting a quarter gallon, maybe two quarter gallons every day. And that made us just come into smaller pastures. Now our pastures are 5 to 10 hectares big, and bufalas rotate through those daily just to get fresh grass and to preserve the pasture and get the best energy out of that. We do have a fixed parlor. We're milking at Huaycaramo 800 buffaloes a day right now. We're expanding our operation to 500 more buffaloes a day in another location, but very close by. And because of the rains and how the terrain works, we have to, let's say, have a place that's firm and clean for us to milk the water buffalo. It's a mechanical milking parlor, just like the ones used for cows, with the difference that there's calves right next to the buffalo. So it requires them to be close to their mom, and then makes the moms just be at ease when they're being at the parlor. We do it once a day for some of them and twice a day for other buffaloes that are more productive. And that's how we ended up managing our milking. But milking, I'm sure Sarah told you, it's it's a psychological work. This is like coaching bufalas. Bufalas need to be convinced of giving you the milk. They're not going to just give it because they're there, like a cow. A cow will yield the milk. She's walking to the parlor and the milk is coming out of their udder. Bufalas are hiding the milk. They're really, they cherish their milk and it's natural. They're just keeping the milk for the calf. So when they go to the parlor, they need the music, they need the time, the routine, the noise, the water, and we give them a little bit of a prize. It could be hay, it could be a little bit of other non-GMO foods that we have, just to cherish them and make them be happy at the parlor. So it's a coaching process to give that we need to give the bufala so they can give us milk. It's challenging, but it's also lovely because they do just fall in love with bufalas and their personalities and how they operate.
Yes, and that's a theme that keeps coming up when I talk to people, whether it's you know, it's in Italy or in the United States, and I'm talking to you, it's just the reverence that people have for the water buffalo, the respect and the nurturing that the water buffalo demand. Right?
Yes.
I mean, they are like you were talking about, like the water, you know, the buffalo that is stressed, you let them be, right? Yeah. And it's such a psychological relationship, and knowing your herd, and it's just fascinating to me. So where did the cheesemakers learn the process of making buffalo milk cheese?
That was quite a challenge because I first, when we said, let's make buffalo mozzarella, I said, okay, I need to go to Italy and see what this is all about. So we went to Italy. I spent a week with the Herreras there. And then I stood for another 2 weeks just touring around looking at cheese facilities. And I saw, you know, quite a few different facilities in southern Italy. Finally, I came to one of them where I met a great friend of mine. He actually left yesterday to Italy. He was here last week. We meet every year just to fine tune our recipe. And I met there Michele, and with Michele we became good friends. I think we just had a good click. And in that trip to Italy, I said, Michele, would you ever come to Colombia and make cheese? And he laughed a little bit. And I think he had to look at the map that night. But he committed. And I just don't take no for an answer. So I said, Michele, you have to go. This is beautiful. You're going to love Colombia. You're a traveler. You're Italian. You would love it. He said, okay, I'll go. Let me know when the facility is ready and I'll go. So a year later, I call Michele and say, hey, Michele, remember the crazy Colombian at your facility? He's like, oh, mamma mia. No, mi piace, ti senti, all that. And I said, Michele, I'm ready. When can you come over? He said, well, here it's Christmas. I cannot go for Christmas, but I'll be there the 10th of January, 2009. I said, okay, perfect. I send the tickets and Michele arrives here. It was his first time in South America, but he had been to India. He had been to China. He had been to Romania and other locations making cheese, not buffalo cheese, buffalo mozzarella, but other cheeses. He's a casaro. He's a tecnico casaro. He was born in a cheese vat. His parents were also born in cheese vats. So, so Michele came here and we started making cheese. And I decided not to have anyone at the facility. We were four people at that time. I decided not to have anyone who knew anything about local cheeses because that would bring variations or, let's say, trends that I didn't want to inoculate into my cheese and my milk. So we started with four people and started making the cheese, and we started dumping milk and cheese because we couldn't make it. We couldn't stretch it. And Michele was frustrated. It took us a week of work. And he said, what is going on? I cannot make the cheese. And he read and he went home to the hotel frustrated. And he said, you know what? I need to see the milk. This milk is so different. I said, sure, let's go. So we hop in the car, drive for 6 hours, get to Waikaramo, and he understands finally that this is grass-fed and that this is out and about with no feed. And then he understands that grass-fed milk requires another process. We require a different ferment. There's less fat. There is a different ratio between protein and fat. So we had to do the process differently. And the next 3 weeks, he stood here for a month. We started working beautifully, and we ended up making really good mozzarella. But it was interesting how he had to understand the milk. And that's the recipe that the four of us who were here started to make. And that's the recipe that we fine-tune every year. So there's three cheesemakers, four cheesemakers, and myself. But everyone at the plant knows how to make cheese. We just are always fine-tuning how we do it and the, you know, the sensory analysis, the touch, the stretch, the percent stretch. It's all subjective. And we work on that with Michele all the time. Most of us, I learned Italian while working with Michele here. Some of my colleagues here learned a little bit of cheese Italian.
Yeah.
And we manage some Italian terms that are just innate in our curd. So that's how we did.
It's interesting that you talk about that sensory aspect, because one of the things that I noticed immediately the first time I ever had your cheese was that it is distinctly softer than other buffalo mozzarella I've had. I used it in a class, in a private cheese tasting class years ago, and it was like these little pillows. It was so distinctly different. And then the flavor as well. It's, you know, when you taste it, that it is a buffalo milk mozzarella, but it also tastes very uniquely like its own thing. And I wonder, like, how much of that is the terroir and how much of it was, you know, the ferment that you talk about. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, what do you think is distinct and unique about your mozzarella di bufala?
It's distinct about how the texture goes. It is soft, it is pillowy, it is creamy. Even though the milk has less fat than, let's say, Italian milk, we end up gathering all that milk with the protein that it has, and it has a nice balance between fat and protein. It should keep the structure, though. It should keep the stretch. It should keep the fiber so that you have a bite to it, and it should have the skin. For me, it has a terroir of the tropical grasses. These bufalas are eating things that we never thought they were going to eat. So in the dry season, they're eating leaves from the trees and eating shrubs and other stuff. In the rainy season, they eat the fresh grass. And that's something that I was going to tell you. When we source milk from other farms and we end up mixing the milk, and that's what we do, we end up bringing that mix of milks to be a standard, because it could be rainy on one side of the mountain, but then on the other side of the Andes, it could be dry, so fat is concentrated more. We ended up milk mixing because it makes our milk more homogeneous no matter what time of the year it is. And that's the challenge with grass-fed cheeses, that if it's the fall or if it's the spring, then your cheese changes completely. Here, since there's no seasons, it's just rainy or dry, we make that blend, and that terroir from the different regions comes into the milk vat. And makes it more or less homogeneous every month. There has to be some tropical Colombia in that flavor that distinct makes Buff a distinctive product and taste different. There's some grass in it. I feel grass when I try Buff, and I feel that difference that you mentioned when I try it and compare it. It should be sweet, should be fresh, and it should be smooth.
So on that note, we're gonna take a little break for a word from one of the wonderful sponsors of our podcast, and then we will be right back with more with Alejandro Gomez Torres.
This episode of Cutting the Curd is brought to you by Conte Cheese Association. Conte Cheese Association represents the Conte PDO, Conte Protected Designation of Origin in the USA. Conte is a raw milk cooked pressed cheese from the Jura Mountains of France. There, every day, 2,500 family farms deliver milk to over 150 local cheesemaking facilities, or fruitiers. This milk must be transformed into Comté within 24 hours of milking to preserve the lactic microflora in the milk, ensuring the cheese's aromatic potential. About 105 gallons of milk are required to craft a single wheel of Comté. Comté takes time to acquire its flavors in the affinage cellars. After 8 months of aging by dedicated affineurs on average, each wheel of Comté is graded and shipped to market. No wheel of Comté is the same. Its flavors speak to the pastures where the cows grazed, the season in which it was made, the particular craftsmanship of the cheesemaker, and the time spent in the aging cellar. Therefore, every wheel of Comté is unique. Learn more about Comté, an iconic cheese from the Jura Mountains of France, favored by cheesemongers and cheese lovers all over the world. Find out more at comté-usa.com. That's comté-usa.com.
Thank you again for joining us on this episode of Cutting the Curd. We are talking again about water buffalo, and this time my guest is Alejandro Gomez Torres of Boof Creamery. This is water buffalo, mozzarella de bufala in Colombia, but it is widely distributed in the United States now and has been for a few years. I'm lucky to be in the New York, metro area where Boof is a common sight for me. And I did want to say that I noticed that in addition to making mozzarella, and you make burrata as well, you also make halloumi, ricotta, and yogurt. Yes. Are you at the point now where you're diversifying? And I'm also wondering how these products how they're different from their cow's milk counterparts.
Yes, I think we don't want to diversify too much because one of the best, I think the best moves we've done is concentrate in where buffalo milk really shines. We could make any cheese out of water buffalo. We could make any spread, any sweet caramel sauce. We could make anything. But it really makes a difference when you make mozzarella. We identified that burrata is also one of those products that if you make it with water buffalo, it makes a difference. Even though we use some cow's milk into our cream to make it a little bit more fluid. So burrata is a mixed milk product from our portfolio. We're now, as of this week, Jessica, we are working on a 100% water buffalo burrata that will be all with our cream. We just need to make that cream stable throughout the 45 days. So shelf life becomes an issue, but it's beautiful. That cream is just amazing when we just try that fresh cream. It tastes like toasted almonds, a little bit sweet. That might be coming soon. Halloumi is one of those obsessions of mine. I think we do not distribute it widely because of making volume, so that becomes a little bit hard. But we do make halloumi. We sell some halloumi in the U.S., some here in Colombia. It's an obsession of mine. When I went and tried halloumi for the first time in a food show, I was just overwhelmed by how great it was. And we really like cooking cheeses or hot cheese is just great. So that's a product that is more of one of those just mental things that you have to do. So we made halloumi, and then yogurt became. We don't sell yogurt in the United States. We do sell the yogurt here in Colombia. It became a way of showing more the attributes of this beautiful milk. So without any additives, without any other ingredients besides milk and ferments, we get a very dense, creamy yogurt that really, really shines. So ricotta then becomes one of those byproducts that you have to have when you're making pasta filata cheese or making cheese in general. We do make ricotta. We sell a lot of ricotta. It is a very delicate product, but it's great protein and has some of that fat of our milk. It's sweet and nice. So that's our line. We're not looking for more products in our line. We're just looking to perfectionate our cheeses and our yogurts. and bringing the best of that milk into everyone's plate. That's our goal.
So you talked, you mentioned shelf life, and that's always an issue for us in the United States, when we're importing mozzarella di bufala from Italy. Those of us who are in sales or logistics know, like, okay, if it's being made on this day and then it gets to the airport and then it flies over and then it gets into the warehouse and then it gets picked up and it gets delivered sometimes to another warehouse before it gets to the retailer. And we're always doing the math, and we're always thinking about, you know, the product and how to get the freshest product to the store. And I'm curious about the logistics of getting these fresh cheeses from Colombia to the United States. And what was that like when you first started out versus now that you're kind of up and running with a larger operation?
It's funny because, you know, buffaloes are so slow. You know, they walk slowly. You go to the parlor, everything's slow. You milk them, it's so slow. But once that milk comes out from that udder, it's just a rush. So logistics start from the parlor, and the buffaloes are... the line has the slow beginning and then the slow end, and I'll explain it. We milk those buffaloes, and then the milk's in the truck. Then it's being trucked to the facility. We make it into mozzarella. And there's a few things we do for shelf life. We do a very clean milk first. Second, we obviously pasteurize our milk. All of them are pasteurized. We use ferments that we import from Italy that are specific for our product, as I mentioned, and they are ferments that stop their process once they reach certain pH. So that actually lets the cheese kind of like set in that picture once it's made. And then we pack our cheese in pasteurized water brine just to make sure that we have no other agents here working with our cheese. So part of the process, that process plus the packaging gives us that shelf life. We guarantee 45 days. And I'm going to be sincere with you. The cheese changes through those 45 days. But we designed a process and we stretch our cheese with the moisture to make the cheese perfect at day 20 or 25. Because that's on average when our customer is going to eat and share our cheese. If you try it out of the stretcher, you're going to think it's chewy and a little bit rubbery. Yes, there's a lot of fiber because we're stretching it to make it last. And we're just spurging, just releasing all that whey, because the whey will keep on acidifying the cheese and it'll shorten the shelf life. So the process is a process that's not for a mozzarella that you're going to eat today when it's made. It'll be ideal at day 20. And that's when logistics come in. And in order to make it on time to Seattle or on time to Chicago for day 20 or 25, well, we need to rush. And that's when we ship off everything on planes. And one huge thing about Colombia is that we are the number one producer of cut flowers in the world. So cut flowers are all flown all over the world. We piggyback on those airplanes that are temperature controlled, and that's how we get into the U.S. and Chile, for example. We also export to Chile. And then that rush goes into a truck, and then trucks will deliver this with the flowers, with the cut flowers into where we sell the product. And then it all comes to slow, and it's when it sits on the shelf, it's a little slow, and then when you go and serve it on the table, it's, you know, around a glass of wine with a candle and with friends. And that's the slow part again. So there's a cycle of slow rush, slow, trying to make it onto the table on day 25, knowing that if you eat it on day 45, it should be fine. It should be a little softer. Maybe that ciliegina that you tried was maybe at the end of the shelf life, but it should still be sweet and creamy. It shouldn't be acidic. It should still hold well, even though the texture changes. But we had to work around that because we knew that it had to last if we wanted to share it with the world.
I do want to also congratulate you on the Square container, which I believe, I think it was one of the first ones that yes, I saw. Yes. And it definitely made you stand out on a shelf. And also, it's so easy to stack. And you can, you know, it's such a great, it was just such a great idea for packaging. And I definitely noticed it. So, and now we're seeing more and more of the cube packaging out there. And in that respect, like with marketing your cheeses, was that something you did with partners in the United States, or was that all done in Colombia?
No, that's me with a little cooler walking around. Yeah, literally that's what we did. And we had good connections definitely to start. My great partner Chip in the US, who was a co-founder of Boof, he was a door opener for us with different retailers. And he had the doors and I had the story and the passion. So we both went together with our cooler. I remember he had a great suitcase, one of those 70s aluminum suitcase, like the ones that flew to the moon. And we would walk into our meetings with that suitcase full of cheese and let people try it. So it was through mouth that we had people try our cheese. It was sending the cheese to everyone and letting everyone try it. And then basically what really helped us was to be the only one with visibility as a brand. I think Boof, you can see from far away, and it makes you want to double click in and understand what's in there. And once you start reading, there's a story behind, there's, you know, made in Colombia is so strange, but at the same time, it's kind of hip and interesting. So I think there's a lot of coherence between our branding, our story, and our product. And that helped us a lot. And with great customers that we have, that we're advocates and we're promoting our cheese and just mentioning how great it was. I think that's what helped us with marketing. But it's been all done, you know, walking around and going to food shows and getting the feedback from everyone, people from all over the world trying the cheese and saying, I like it. I think it's too salty. I think it's too hard. I think it's too soft. You always get opinions, but that's how it goes.
So in looking into the future, you were talking about the growth and creating a larger network of suppliers of buffalo milk, working with more farmers. Are these farmers that are changing over their herd, or are they people who had buffalo milk and, you know, water buffalo and maybe weren't raising them for milk? What's the vetting process as you start to bring more farmers into your fold?
It's people who have water buffalo, but they didn't know the potential of this animal. So they had it as an animal to take care of complicated terrains, let's say, terrains that are floodable, terrains that have a lot of weeds and they cannot really go and clean up. So buffaloes were there a little bit relegated to the background. So we go to we are members of the Association of Buffalo Breeders of Colombia. We are pioneers with you know, producing cheese. We're well respected in this group of people. And you know, we go around and say, hey guys, look, you have a gold mine with your buffaloes. Let's clean that milk. Let's make that milk Boof milk. So what we do is we just install cold tanks. See if we have to bring power, electricity, we find the way to do so. We try to incentivate, you know, milking activities, milking practices, proper milking. And we pick up the milk at everyone's farm. They don't have to haul or anything. We just go pick it up in our trucks. So it became an easy way to get an extra revenue from your farm. And people who really got into it now have buffaloes as their own business. They sold their other cattle herd and expanded buffaloes because they can have the three purposes. They can have milk, then they can have meat for sale when they're older or the steer. And then draft power is also something available if you want to sell some buffaloes for draft power. So we taught people the potential that buffalo had, and that word of mouth within Colombia just became a way to call people call us and say, hey, I have 50 herd. What can I do? Well, let's work it out. You might need a little bit more to have economies of scale. But I think we're just motivating all buffalo breeders to get into water buffaloes and to do it in the right way. We don't need changes. We want them to be free roaming. We want them to be swimming in the pool. We want them to be out there with the birds. Keep it as it is. We don't want to invent anything that's been perfected by nature for centuries. Keep it as it is. Let's just make them milking friendly. And we have a grass scientist in our company that does it all. Miguel goes around through the farms, checking out the grass. At the end of the run is grass availability that makes buffaloes happy and therefore the milk good.
And that's what it's all about, right?
Yes.
You have to have great milk, which comes from great grass and, and keeping the environment and the land open. And I think that that's actually a beautiful place for us to end this interview. I have to say that one of the things that always interested me about the story of Boof was the logistics, the fact that it came here piggybacking on the transport of fresh cut flowers. And I just think that that is so beautiful.
It is a good gift.
It is. It's a beautiful thing. And I'm really looking forward to hopefully meeting you in person. Hopefully as we are back into the events and the gatherings in the cheese community. And I really thank you for being our guest today on Cutting the Curd.
Thank you, Jessica. It's an honor. And thank you, because going through the story here as we speak just makes me, I get a little bit of my skin gets bumpy just because of remembering the path that we've been through and how it all was, 13 years ago when we were just milking 35 water buffalo. And now, having some brand recognition and being able to share that deliciousness around the U.S. and Chile and Colombia, I think it makes me really happy and it makes, I see smiles and I see good comments and I see people share it. And that's what it's all about. It's all about deliciousness. It's all about great food and sharing it around your friends and family. The life doesn't go any further than that, So we love to be part of that. And thank you for the opportunity to share this story. And I would be happy to meet you anytime. I'll be in the U.S. very soon. So, and also, please feel free to come to Colombia and if anyone wants to visit Colombia, it's very easy, great place. And the water buffalo side of Colombia is amazing. So we're open to anyone who would love to visit.
Okay. So it sounds like there's a lot of travel plans are about to be made. So thank you again for joining us. And thank you everyone for listening. Don't forget, you can always find our episodes on the Heritage Radio Network website and on your favorite streaming platforms, and check out our Instagram. And again, thank you to our sponsors. And we'll see you next time on Cutting the Curd.
This show is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.